The village of Chelm, all the sages agree, was created on the sixth day when humanity was fresh. But the exact mechanism of Chelm's birth is a topic of great debate amongst the scholarly and devout. On the subject of Chelmogenesis, our three rabbis were split. Reb Mizel, Reb Mazel, and Reb Mitzel. Going about their business, they resemble a lumpy black cat, its three heads constantly mewling and chasing its tail. Reb Mizel was of the belief that an angel, flying about distributing souls, ran smack into a tree, spilling an entire sack of souls down into the valley. Reb Mazel held a similar belief, but with the crucial and non-negotiable difference that said angel sack sagged and was caught on the tip of Mount Tumbis, whipping a hole for which all the souls tumbled down into the valley. Reb Mitzel simply taught that God said, "Let there be Chelm," and there was Chelm, and it was good. That selection comes from very early on in the play, and it introduces three of the most recurring characters in the play, the three rabbis of Chelm, Reb Mizel, Reb Mazel, and Reb Mitzel, discussing Chelm's mythic origins as a village. In reality, Chelm is an actual small town in eastern Poland, but what it's most known for is its fictional counterpart, which is sort of a mainstay of Ashkenazi Jewish folklore. The concept of like a village of fools or a village of idiots comes up in lots of different kinds of folklore from a variety of cultures. And for the Jews of Eastern Europe, that was Chelm, a place where everyone from the street sweeper all the way up to the mayor is a total fool, a total clownish idiot, and where everyone considers himself a genius. Yonkel on the Moon follows the titular character, Yonkel, who is the only surviving member of the Chelm community. And over the course of the play, he brings to life over a dozen of the villagers through storytelling. And we see what happens when these sort of mythic figures encounter the historical realities of the Holocaust and Yonkel's journey as the sole survivor. How can he keep his people alive, keep Chelm alive, when he's the only one left? In creating the piece and developing it, I was very much reacting against the sort of extant traditions of Holocaust representation, the standard of stark realism and tragedy, and yes, even occasionally melodrama. What I was responding to was feeling that those modes were not really effective for my generation, for the 21st century. My generation has never not known about the Holocaust. You know, we are the Jews who grew up with these twin maxims of never again and never forget, very different from the first generation who experienced it, responded often with silence. My grandfather, who survived the Holocaust, didn't talk about it really for decades. Then you have the second generation, my parents, who responded to the silence of their parents with mass proliferation, you know, plays and books and stories and paintings and poetry and talking about it. And it is in that sort of environment of mass discourse that my generation came up. And so for me, it was sort of, how do I talk about this? How do I tell this story in a way that my generation can relate to? How do I tell the story that I would want or need to hear? And for me, comedy has always been my way into everything. I believe really strongly in the power of comedy to transform and to heal and to turn things upside down. And theatrically, I'm interested in tragicomedy. I read some scholar when I was doing initial research who talked about tragicomedy like 3D glasses. And the idea that you get both dimensions, you get the blue and the red, and sort of oscillates the audience back and forth continuously throughout the production, that they can't really get away from what's happening, you know? It doesn't let you dwell for too long on the horror and the atrocity, but it also doesn't let you enjoy the lightness and the humor for too long either way. It keeps people in between, and I think it really opens them up toward hearing the story. One of the most difficult segments in the entire play comes over three quarters of the way in when Yonkel meets the Angel of Death. And that character has been so difficult to portray and to land on a physicality and a vocal quality. And we have spent months trying to figure out, what does that character sound like? What does that character look like? She was a Yiddish mama. She was like this brassy New Yorker voice. She was a he. We tried a variety of genders and non-genders, so many different physical choices. And the way that the character is now played, which I think is one of the starkest and maybe most frightening moments in the play, wasn't settled on until like the day before we opened. So the way the play functions essentially is there's no intermission and it runs just over an hour, but it's got a bit of an act one, act two feel. Act one is kind of before the fall, as it were, and it consists of my adaptations of classic Helm tales, stories that have been told for hundreds of years in so many different ways. So in Act One, a lot of the tales are things that I read, you know, 10 different versions of, and then I wrote my own version, my own take on it. So one of those stories is one of the most classic Helm tales of all, and it's the story of the Helmers capturing the moon in the barrel. And the basic idea is the people of Helm need a way to light their dirt roads on dark nights, you know? And in the folklore, there are a variety of reasons for this. People are tripping and falling, or in one version, actually, you know, the Jews live on a lunar calendar, and there are certain prayers that are offered on full moon nights. And so in some versions, the Helmers want to capture the moon so they can rent it out to Jews from other villages when they need to pray. And so in Act One, I tell the story of Reb Zadel capturing the moon in a barrel, you know? He sees the reflection of the moon in the barrel's surface, and in the logic of the Helmers' minds, they go, oh, the moon has come down for a bath. We will slam the lid on top and nail it down, and we'll have the moon there in the barrel for when we need it next. And of course, when they are finally ready to use the moon, they open the barrel and it's gone. And in the mind of the Helmers, there is never a self-awareness that, oh, we were being ridiculous, it was just the reflection. No, the response is, of course, someone must have stolen the moon! And so we've got this incredible set piece, this barrel, that really looks more like the skeleton of a barrel. Yonkel, when the Holocaust arrives in Helm, when the Germans come and build a ghetto and then eventually liquidate Helm, Yonkel hides from the attack by jumping into the water barrel to hide, and he is instantly transported to the moon. In a moment that is as literal as it is metaphorical, I have not made up my mind. I don't feel the need to about, is he actually on the moon? Is this PTSD? Is he hallucinating? It could be any of those things. But in that moment, this bit of foolish joking that was established earlier in the play becomes Yonkel saving grace. And he survives, but he has to witness the destruction of his people from afar. And for the rest of the play, he is alone. And that central metaphor of Yonkel on the moon reflects my own experience, feeling that the Holocaust and those events is deeply embedded in my identity. It's in my blood and my bones. But at the same time, the distance between myself and those events feels interstellar, you know? I have never feared for my life for being a Jew. Then how do I grapple with this thing that is part of my identity, and yet I can't relate to it at all?